You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tekert. What is in a story? Personal narratives have this long history of driving our politics. For advocacy groups, polished testimonials are as important as data when it comes to getting laws changed. And the U.S. State Department, reckoning with the failure of occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan, they even started running storytelling workshops in those places to try to prompt a cultural shift. Our next guest is just out with a deep critique of the types of stories and the forms of storytelling that have come to dominate our political moment. A turn towards stories about individuals advancing themselves instead of knowing themselves. A turn towards stories of personal initiative rather than collective action. A turn towards stories of individual triumphs that blot out discussion of structures and institutions. Sujatha Fernandez is a professor of political economy and sociology at the University of Sydney. She's the author of many books. Her latest is Curated Stories, The Uses and Misuses of Storytelling. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So I'd like to start with your opening example.
Some people call me the girl who was shot by the Taliban.
The Nobel Prize winner Malala Yousafzai.
And some, the girl who fought for her rights.
Could you start by just describing how her story gets presented?
Yes, so Malala Yousafzai is very well known for being shot in the head by the Taliban when she was trying to attend school in the Swat Valley of Pakistan where she was growing up. And this, of course, is something that happened. But the ways in which her story gets spun is to become one in which all of the context is taken away and she simply comes to represent the desire of girls for an education, the desire of girls to better themselves against this kind of male patriarchal Taliban organization that just wants to repress women and repress women's rights, which is a narrative that's quite convenient and fits with a lot of the sort of geopolitical goals of the United States, with foreign policy goals of the war in Afghanistan. And so what we see in the making of Malala in terms of her media personality, in terms of the film that was made about her, the ways in which she's marketed, is a lot of other things drop out. So, for instance, her critique of war drops out. We don't hear about Malala as somebody who is critical of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. What we hear about her simply is that she's a girl who wants education. And so it's this very kind of simple narrative that comes to dominate in the media and comes to dominate in the talk shows. That is what the world kind of learns about her.
So the issue here is not actually that she's omitting her critique of the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan. It's that the systems her story gets distributed through are selective.
That's correct. It's the ways in which her story is filtered, the ways in which the aspects that fit the convenient narrative of U.S. foreign policy are amplified, and those aspects that don't fit that narrative are omitted.
So then you wind up with something that justifies an ongoing presence because of the objectively awful things that the Taliban does.
Yes, that's right.
So what is the bigger trend that this represents in storytelling?
So I see this in a moment of sort of the broader cultural zeitgeist being one of Facebook, of TED Talks, a moment of heavily curated stories where we're always presenting ourselves and our experiences to others, whether it's through social media, whether it's through institutions like TED. Things that may seem completely spontaneous, that we're just talking about what we did today or, you know, giving a talk about education, are actually the product of quite heavy scrutiny, quite rehearsals, and staging of who we are. And so that's the broader cultural context in which I think what I call curated storytelling emerges. But then we also have the more specific historical context. And I locate this the kind of storytelling presidency of Barack Obama, which is, you know, in the 2004 Democratic National Convention is when he first tells his story.
Let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely.
The humble son of an African man who marries this American woman.
My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya.
and his rise to power, how he has sort of risen from these humble roots. And this story that he tells becomes the basis first for his 2008 bid for the presidency, which relies on all of these storytelling workshops that motivate young people to then go out and campaign for Obama and elect Obama. And in the aftermath of that campaign, that storytelling technique and even Obama's story itself is disseminated in a whole range of nonprofits and organizing groups, and from climate change to the immigrant rights movement, with the idea that telling your curated story, and these are very heavily curated stories, they're generally 3 to 5 minute stories, where people's experiences are kind of used to push forward a certain legislative issue, can be used in bringing about these different kinds of electoral and legislative changes.
The 2004 speech is really interesting. It definitely put him on the national stage. It wasn't the first time he told it. He'd been rehearsing it and iterating it over hundreds of stump speeches since he started his political career in Chicago.
That's right. And it's, you're right, it's not the first time that he told the story, but it's the time when he kind of hits the stage with this impact that then reverberates beyond the political sphere. And so this is when we start to see that story, that heavily crafted story, then become the model for instance, Marshall Ganz's workshops in Harvard on storytelling. And Marshall Ganz trains a number of activists and of leaders and political strategists and a whole lot of people in how to tell their story. And he uses Obama's DNC speech as the model. And that sort of sets off a wave of this kind of curated storytelling that becomes much more broadly used.
I mean, that speech is interesting. It is definitely inspiring. It describes an America that does not really exist for many Americans.
There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America.
It is one where we can set aside our differences and move forward as an inclusive society. There's no red America and blue America. There's just the United States of America. It's really devoid of any discussion of structures driving inequality and vast social problems, the things that are usually the province of politics.
So that's what's so effective about it, right? It's a moving speech. We listen to it and we identify with it, and you can see how people who may have also come from the same kind of humble beginnings as Obama might look and say, wow, someone like him could become the president of America. And so there's this really sort of inspiring nature to it, at the same time that, you're right, it doesn't talk about any kind of structural conditions. It leaves out any discussion of, for instance, structural inequality, racism as a structure that prevents certain people from being able to rise, to being able to have that kind of social mobility. Class as another structure. The speech is sort of purely about this American can-do spirit, this, you know, self-initiative that it takes. And this is kind of the ideology that's being promoted through this kind of storytelling, is the idea that, you know, that you can do it on your own merit. You don't need, you know, the hand up. You don't need anything. You can do it.
So what are the consequences of using that 2004 speech by Barack Obama as a template for the storytelling workshops that Marshall Ganz is teaching?
So in my book, I looked specifically at the ways that the template and the story and then the workshop model devised around it were used within the immigrant rights movement, and particularly with the undocumented student dreamer movement. And I think they really, that speech and the ways in which the workshops were devised, which was a very sort of top-down, this is the narrative, and then you have to all fit your stories of growing up undocumented and, you know, realizing that you didn't really have a future without a social security number, fit that narrative of the undocumented student into Obama's narrative and into that 5 minute story. And so, you know, there were thousands of trainings that took place, and those only the kind of official ones, because then, dreamers themselves took those workshop materials, photocopied them, organized their own workshops. And so we see these workshops being reproduced on a mass scale. And what they're really doing is they're reinforcing the narrative of that from the very first moment, the dreamer movement is something created created in a top-down way by mainstream immigration organizations, we're trying to emphasize, which is the dreamer as the best and the brightest, the young people who were innocent, who were brought here by their parents who came across the border illegally and who have jeopardized and put them in this position, but they are really striving to get to better themselves, for upward mobility, to get an education. And so this is what these immigrant rights organizations were trying to present the dreamers in this light, as these aspiring Americans, and all they want to be is Americans. And through the workshops, this idea becomes the driving force of these stories that young people tell in congressional hearings, they tell to the media, they tell in lobbying, all for the Dream Act and also for comprehensive immigration reform. And that the result of this is that, and you know, I interviewed dreamers and I heard, you know, their reactions to what this was like for them. And, you know, and some of them just said, I got so tired of telling my story. It was so hard to fit the details of a much more complex life story, including one where they felt strong allegiances to their parents, where they identified with the struggles of their parents. You know, they saw their father nervous as he approached, you know, a police car and worried, is he going to get pulled over? And all these fears, and none of that gets represented in the 5-minute story, which all there is time for is to say, this is my story. I am the valedictorian. You know, these are my SAT scores. I just want to become a doctor and help America, and yet I can't because of my lack of a social security number. So that's why I'm fighting for comprehensive immigration reform or the Dream Act. And that's it. And they all said, you know, it's so hard to fit those life details into such a truncated story.
So there's kind of two implicit narratives in every one of those. One is that you can kind of split the 12 million undocumented immigrants living in America at the time into kind of like the deserving undocumented and the undeserving undocumented. And the other implication is that the problem with the dreamers is that their immigration status is what's keeping them from pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, which kind of precludes any discussion about structural inequality or racism or, you know, all the other intersecting problems and systems of oppression that a fully complex human being experiences in their life.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, the issue is that in this, there are all these from the beginning, which was 2001 when the Dream Act first went before Congress, there are, you know, all of these students who are handpicked by the immigration organizations, the students with the stories, again, like Malala Yousafzai, all these students whose stories fit the narrative that they want to promote. And what does that mean? It means that there are all of these stories that are not getting told as well. So the stories of the young people who are not valedictorians, who don't do academically well at school, who are not aspiring to be Americans or doctors or engineers, who may even be gang members, who may have political involvement. There's such a range of stories that get left out of that narrative, and a range of young people. And it is, you know, later towards sort of 2008, 2009, and that these young people start rebelling against this narrative. And they say, you know, we're not going to accept this idea that, you know, we have to be these perfect high SAT scores, high GPAs, and we're not going to accept that we have to reject our parents and, you know, and denounce them in order to get our mobility.
This is the break that takes the form of the undocumented and unafraid movement.
Yes, that's right. And that's when they start to engage in much more direct actions. They do a march, they do sit-ins, they begin to take not just a please give us this Dream Act kind of obedient supplicant kind of act, but rather a much more agentive moment where they say, we're going to demand that something actually happens. And this is then in the lead-up to DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that some people within the Dreamer movement begin to pressure Obama, and they begin to, again, a campaign of sit-ins and direct actions that ultimately lead to Obama passing this policy that is a reprieve from deportation for a certain section of undocumented students. That was a victory for the movement.
It's easy to forget how confrontational that was. Dreamers were occupying Obama campaign offices during the 2012 election. People doing that were risking arrest, knowing the consequence of arrest could be deportation. They were forcing the issue.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's something that, you know, up until that point, they'd mostly been saying, you know, asking politicians to give them protection in this quite, you know, sort of as if the politicians were sort of being paternalistic and helping them. And then they reached a point where they just said, you know, this is not working. The DREAM Act, after numerous times, just failed to pass. And they said, meanwhile, our lives here are on the line. This affects our lives. And who's making the decisions about strategy here? These are these organizations that really, you know, aren't living what we're living through. And so as a basis of their own experience and their own kind of just determination to make something happen, they said, you know, now we're not going to just ask politicians, we're going to demand and we're going to take direct actions until we see some kind of change here.
So this is kind of an example of a larger phenomenon that is quite common among Western academics of trying to identify a universal and what winds up being a prescriptive structure for narratives, for all stories, that there is a character, that person encounters some kind of challenge, the conflict of them trying to overcome that challenge drives the narrative of the entire piece, and it ends with some form of resolution. What does that leave out?
So I think the idea that we can have a conventional storytelling structure, and many sociologists and other academics, as you said, who study storytelling have tried to come up with this very prescriptive formula for this is what stories could be. And the Marshall Gans workshops, along with the Dreamer workshops and all of these others, really draw on that as a way of saying, you know, the individual, you know, has a story, they face a challenge or a conflict at some point, and that challenge or conflict leads them into a life-changing decision, which in the case of the elections is either, you know, the decision to vote for Obama or the decision to fight for his campaign or to fight for comprehensive immigration reform. What I argue in the book is that this idea that we can come up with a prescriptive formula for storytelling is itself a construction, that the idea that storytelling has existed throughout the ages and we can, you know, go back, you know, hundreds of centuries and we can say, you know, back then what they were doing, how they were telling stories is the same thing that we're doing today and that, you know, it's in our DNA. And there's been a number of popular books that have also come out about this kind of a book called The Storytelling Animal. It's been this very kind of influential argument in popular culture and in academia. And what I find is that, in fact, what I think is that storytelling is something that is constructed and that instead the definition of how we define stories is Eurocentric, but also comes from what we want to get out of it. So the Marshall Gans workshops, the Dreamer workshops define storytelling in that way as the individual who makes a choice, who reaches a conflict and faces a challenge is specifically the kind of narrative that will help them to then promote that particular story that they want to about why we need to fight for immigration reform. When we look at other cultures beyond the Western culture, beyond the sort of what's been, you know, seen as the typical story, there are other cultures and other forms where genres where there is no conflict. In some of the narratives in Japanese kind of literature, there is no conflict, right? The tension is built up in other ways and people are drawn into the story in other ways. And so, you know, this model of storytelling is quite culturally specific, even though it's presented as universal. And so I think what's missing is the whole idea that what is a story is something very limited to a kind of historical moment, to a cultural moment, and that different stories serve different purposes and work differently.
So, like, what examples of alternative storytelling forms can you point to? What's a more liberatory practice?
So there's sort of two things that I look at in the book. One thing is if we take things back to the era of the 1960s and 70s, an era of sort of radical movements and organizing in places like Latin America, in the US with the civil rights, black power, feminist movements, we saw there a very different kind of storytelling. So in the women's movement, the whole idea of consciousness raising and telling your personal story, but yet the personal is political, connect reflecting, you know, your personal experience of, say, abuse by a husband or, you know, confinement within the home or whatever the story was that people told, but connecting that to a broader critique, a structural critique of patriarchy, or, you know, the ways in which a form called testimonials or testimonies were used within Latin America during indigenous movements and groups that were suffering genocide by US-sponsored armies and who used their stories to reach out to the broader world as part of solidarity building, to let them know what was happening, how they were being under attack, and to try to build support for their cause. And so I see those as the kind of movement storytelling, and as compared to the curated storytelling of today, I see that movement storytelling as ones that tried to build in a broader critique of structural oppression and that tried to see themselves as part of the collective. It wasn't just about the individual upward mobility, the individual seeking to better themselves, but it was about linking themselves as part of a collectivity, often a movement or an organization. So that's one kind of storytelling.
Before we get into your next example, I wanted to jump on that, sure, because Marshall Gans, the Harvard academic you single out as the purveyor of this kind of prescriptive form of storytelling today, he's a product of that era. He spent 15 years working with the United Farm Workers during exactly the era of radical social change you mentioned.
Absolutely. He is somebody who was involved with the civil rights movement. Then he came and became a leader with the farm worker movement. He was involved with storytelling, you know, with the farm worker movement in California, and was really, again, one of the pioneers of those techniques. And I think, you know, probably his move from farm worker leader to political strategist for the Obama campaign, that trajectory represents very well the trajectory of what I, you know, outlined that happened with storytelling over the period of the 80s and 90s. Which is that through a whole co-optation of social movements that happened as a result of truth commissions, through the whole pacification of radical movements in Latin America, through the co-optation and professionalization of the feminist movement, its move away from those radical stories into things like therapy as a form of social activism. All of those processes, I think, are emblematic in Marshall Gans's own personal story and his move that he made. Those who kind of rebelled, like I mentioned earlier, the dreamers who rebelled against that, the curated stories that they were made to tell, and the domestic workers are another group that I talk about, who also felt, you know, that they, during a Bill of Rights campaign, were, you know, forced to tell these kind of very narrow and prescriptive legislative stories. And both of these groups, the domestic workers and the migrant domestic workers and the undocumented students, both reached a point where either they said, we're not going to tell our stories anymore, or they said, we want to tell different kinds of stories. And what they did was they said, well, you know, we don't know if this is possible to do it in the legislative form, in the congressional hearings, in the legislative hearings. What we want to try and do is look for more creative ways to tell their stories. And so they began to look for doing creative writing workshops, writing poetry. The Dreamers did video storytelling combined with visuals. And so they sort of began to explore all of these different, more artistic types of storytelling that would allow them to really address the complexity of their existence, to critique things like, you know, to talk about their homelands, which is what they weren't often allowed to do in the curated stories. This is another example that I used of some of these uncurated stories.
Sujatha Fernandez, it's a great book. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have to discuss it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sujatha Fernandez is a professor of political economy and sociology at the University of Sydney. Her new book, Curated Stories, The Uses and Misuses of Storytelling.